decided to have a panel discussion on the theme of the history of EAP and of Bali. I woke up this morning sort of two phrases in my head, and I don't know about you, but if I wake up with some ideas, I generally think they're quite valuable. In light of day, they're not necessarily, but anyway, the two phrases were, one was, it'll all be over in a flash, and the other phrase was discourse community. And I can't quite work out why, but I wondered if, I think they both expressed some sort of anxiety on my part. The first kind of comes under the sign of Janus, and or Janus, as I believe the Romans would have said. Of course, the Janus moment is the part of the title of the conference. Perhaps that Janus will strike me down if we don't get this right, or something like that, or we are playthings of the gods and they kill us for their sport, or something like that, or more positively perhaps the idea of getting some perspective on things through looking at the history. A discourse community, an anxiety, I think my own anxiety of being an outsider to this discourse community of EAP. I'm not from the world of EAP, and I'm sitting next to the high priest of EAP, John Swales, perhaps, and a high priestess, Mary Law, and a temple guardian, perhaps. But more positively, perhaps, discourse community. A colleague of mine in the field of history of applied linguistics, which is where my research interests lie, history of applied linguistics, history of English language teaching, Andrew Lynn, professor at Sheffield, he's a professor of history of linguistics. He's actually used the notion of discourse community to talk about the history of applied linguistics in a relatively recent article in a journal called Historiographia Linguistica, which is a very specialized journal in the field of history of linguistics. And he talks about the reform movement people, Viator, Henry Sweet, Johann Storm, people in the 1880s in Europe, as describes them as a discourse community, or an emerging, first stirrings of applied linguistics, really. So that's a connection, perhaps. I think it's a useful notion for discussing the history of a field, a history of ideas, history of practices. Why did I decide to organize this event? Well, I saw the title of the conference, and with my interest in history and the possible relevance of history, because I'm an applied linguist, I'm in the field of English language teaching, and I see history as an important part of our field. In practical terms, not simply as an academic field of interest. I decided that it would be good in the context of this conference to have a session which was looking seriously at the history of EAP and of Bali. Reasons for history, firstly to celebrate, because this is the closest conference, I think, to the 40th anniversary of the foundation of Selmus, or Bali as it became. So a kind of 40th birthday celebration, if you like, but also reasons for history to evaluate. I think this is where the Janus moment part of the conference title comes in. Looking back to look forward. Janus being the god, or Janus being the god of beginnings and transitions, and with two faces, one looking back and one looking forward. I wonder how the conference organizers felt when ELT Journal brought out a special issue to celebrate the retirement of Keith Morrow, because he called that issue the Janus Papers. This was in October last year. I suppose that independently, Keith Morrow and the organizers of the conference were thinking about Janus. More about maybe Janus or Janus later, but history as a field of research within applied linguistics is not very well established. But the people like H.H. Stern in his Fundamental Concepts of Language Teaching, 1983, very strongly emphasized the importance of a historical perspective for our field, or fields. And I found that in preparing a little bit for this conference that In John Swales' own episodes in ESP, this perspective is present. A series of reprinted articles, but with very full introductions. And in the introduction to this, John explicitly says that there is a value in looking back for present-day purposes. So there's support for this idea of history, historical research, as an important part of our field, which I hope this panel discussion will help to establish. By the way, I kind of squirm a little bit when I read that introduction, because you talk about an ESP archive at Aston, which you started developing in Khartoum, which unfortunately is no more. I'm very upset about that, because it was built up lovingly, I think, at Aston, and it has gone the way of, for example, the British Council's ETIC library, English Teaching Information Centre, in other words, to landfill or to an incinerator. And I think that's symptomatic of perhaps a lack of serious thought given to the needs for history in our profession. Well, to evaluate, to use history as a way of looking forward, I think that we need certain things. We need archives, we need to look at primary sources as part of serious historical research, and the Warwick ELT archive, this is the blue pamphlet that I've distributed, we have tried to set up over the last 10 years as a place where documents, important documents from the history of ELT generally, can be deposited and made available for anybody interested in researching in the field of ELT or the history of applied linguistics. So I suppose one purpose of today is to, and we've been helping Andy with his own research into the history of Bali, which has been leading up to this conference, and sharing certain documents, not many, but so that together we can re-establish some of the history, particularly of Bali. Another thing that needs to be done, I think, is oral history. Interviews with leading figures in the field. So we need to have a mix of, to evaluate the past in order to look forward to the future, we need to have a mixture really of talks or interviews or reminiscences by people, important people who've lived through the history. Today we have John and Mariel, and we're very grateful and honoured to have them with us. A mixture of that with research looking at primary sources, and Andy is a good example of that. So I think we're just at the beginnings of research into the field of EAP, although I did hear from Avril just before that there is a PhD student called Doug Bell. Is he here? Doug, looking at the origins of EAP. Sorry? He's at the conference. So I hear that there is somebody doing a PhD research into the history of EAP, which is great. It's what I wanted to sort of say we need more of. And I hope that we'll talk with him later. But if you have primary sources, you know, mimeographs, etc., from the early days or the history of Bali, let's get them together and help Andy with his research into the history of Bali and the general history of EAP. So one purpose of today is to establish the seriousness, I suppose, of history as a field of research. Well, some questions that we might bear in mind, it's not going to be just us talking, but we're looking forward very much to hearing from John and Mariel, and I'm not going to have any time limit on what they have to say. I might try to cut Andy down to size. But before we do come on to hearing from John, first of all, and later Mariel and Andy, some questions that we might bear in mind as we listen, but also we very much want to have your participation in this discussion. Well, some questions we might bear in mind. Where did EAP, where did Bali come from? Origins, why did they arise? How have they developed or changed? How have they not changed? Or what has been consistent? What have been consistent defining themes, if you like? What does this history, what do these histories tell us which is of value for the future? And if you agree that looking into history is a valuable pursuit, how can we continue to develop historical consciousness in the field. Just briefly, there are not many secondary accounts, really, of the history of EAP or of Bali. As I said, I think it's a rich field for research. Bob Jordan, who can't be here, unfortunately, but he did write an article in 2002 in the first issue of JEEP, of the Journal of English for Academic Purposes, which actually coincided with the 30th anniversary of Bali. And he wrote a history of, well, basically it was a history of Bali. In the same issue, Ken Hyland and Liz Hamp-Lyons took a broader view, perhaps, not really history, but it was identifying some themes of change in those 30 years. I suppose more typical in the field is actually Bob Jordan's CUP book, 1997, English for Academic Purposes, which has a very, very, very short background section to the development of EAP. It's only half a page. And this is more typical of, I think, the field of ELT generally, that history is generally there as a sort of very brief thing to set off the present, which is seen as the most important thing. But from these two articles mainly, I've identified a few strands of interest which could inform a history. As I said, we're just at the beginnings of really researching it. But some things I picked out were, you know, themes or issues, trends, might be, all of the books tend to emphasize the expansion of EAP over these 40 years. Expansion in numbers of students, expansion in numbers of teachers, expansion in numbers of publications. Also professionalization, very much connected with associations like Bali. We might think about antecedents, origins. One thing I've got from the archive is this ETIC, occasional paper from the British Council in 1963, called Linguistic Problems of Overseas Students in Britain by George Perrin, who was the director of the English Teaching Information Centre. Other things also worthy of note, which I won't go into now. Something which, as an outsider to EAP, you know, something which I think needs clarification is the relations between EAP and ESP, and also with English for Science and Technology. This is a complicated relationship, but something that a history would need to explore. By the way, the first use of English for Academic Purposes was in 1974, according to what I've read, anyway, in the secondary accounts, by Tim Johns, perhaps, in conversations with the British Council. But by 1975, it was already being used. And in this paper, for example, published again by ETIC, English for Academic Study, 1975, containing important articles by Henry Widdowson and Chris Candlin, for example. Something that seems to me of interest, and again, this is from a naive sort of outsider perspective, is the relationship between practical experience-based insights, as I think are emphasized in a roughly contemporaneous publication, which is the English for Academic Purposes, papers from the very first Bali Selmus seminar, co-organized with Baal. It didn't come out until 1977, but the papers were presented in 1975. Relatively, I suppose, my sort of cursory reading, practically experience-based orientation, compared with the relatively applied linguistic orientation of the British Council's publication here with Henry Widdowson's article. So they maybe have more to say about that later when we come to thinking about Bali and the origins of Bali. A few more themes. I'm interested in the, very much we see in Bob Jordan's article in 2002 a focus on the UK, but what of the developments in the USA and the relationship with EAP or whatever it might be called in the USA and Australia? This needs to be explored. The history of EAP is not the same thing as the history of Bali, of course. And Jordan, in his article, does talk about certain changes in EAP, which are worth highlighting as possible trends which could be further explored. He talks about more attention over the first 30 years of BALEAP being paid to academic culture and critical EAP, team teaching, cooperation or otherwise with specialist departments, developments in needs analysis, developments in testing, of course, developments or otherwise in professional status and identity and job security of EAP lecturers, developments in materials, and of course, as Andy will probably say, CELMUS was originally established very much with materials in mind, developments, of course, in ICT, composition of the student body, developments in the level of English of the students, related to cultural issues. Developments in research in EAP, now this is where perhaps Bob Jordan's article doesn't go into great detail, but he talks about also future possibilities in the area of teacher training for EAP. So these are all sort of themes or things which I picked out in my reading of secondary accounts. We've also very recently received from Jane Jordan, on behalf of Bob Jordan, a file which is of interest for the origins of CELMUS and BALEAP, and I might come back to that later. But in that file, Bob Jordan talks about a sort of shift from an early focus on materials and towards a focus on needs analysis and towards a focus on various specialised areas of research. And he's talking specifically about BALEAP seminars. From the article by Ken Hyland and Liz Hamp-Lyons in 2002, they focus, I'll just mention the extra sort of areas of change that they highlight. Expansion in the nature of the users of academic English. They mention school children, and they also mention non-native speaker lecturers at universities. A rise of notions of academic literacy, discourse specificity. They talk about a lot of research in the 1980s and 90s. Genre, discourse community. They also talk about new genres and new media and developments of debates about whether EAP should involve accommodation or critique. And of course we have the issues which are being raised by the plenary speakers here. So these are all sort of ingredients, themes, possible themes for history. But we do need to consult primary sources, not just these secondary accounts. As I said, Jane Jordan sent us some files recently, which I think shed some interesting light on a tension which may have existed between practice or experience orientation and research orientation in the UK, in BALEAP, and also raise issues in my mind about the relationship with EAP in Britain, in British higher education institutions, and projects overseas administered by the British Council. So I'm going to, as I said, I might come back to that later, but I'd like to hand over to John, because I think those last two perhaps might be things that he can talk about more expertly. Well, he can talk about everything more expertly than me. Let me introduce John in some detail, because I think when I've introduced people saying they need no introduction, I've then thought, well, actually, some of the younger students or people, they don't actually know that much about the pioneers in our field. So just in case, John graduated from Cambridge in 1957 in psychology. This is from Wikipedia, by the way, so you'll correct me if any details are in need of correction. Taught in southern Italy and Sweden. He became then assistant lecturer at the University of Libya from 1963 to 65. He returned to take an advanced diploma at the University of Leeds. Subsequently, went back to the Middle East and became head of the English section at the College of Engineering in Tripoli. He then spent 3 years at Leeds Institute of Education, where and then in 1973 went to Sudan. He became director of the English Language Servicing Unit University of Khartoum in South Sudan. In 1978, he returned to the UK, where he became senior lecturer, later reader, in the Language Studies Unit at Aston University, which I noticed was rather quaintly termed Aston in Birmingham. Is that right? In some of these documents, it reminds me of Henley in Arden or Henley on Thames. So he became head, later Langstroth's unit, Aston in Birmingham University, where he jointly developed the first master's course in the teaching of ESP. In 1985, he moved to the University of Michigan, became professor of linguistics and director of the English Language Institute. He retired in 2007, but he remains emeritus professor of linguistics and active as a scholar and materials writer, as you will see from your conference bag. And of course, he's been very influential in the field, in areas including genre analysis, the notion of discourse community, design of materials closely, and the design of materials for advanced learners, and with my case, the corpus, academic corpus. He's written episodes in ESP, which I showed you, many other books, including genre analysis, and the famous and much used academic writing for graduate students. And a book that I very much enjoy reading is a recent book called Incidents in an Educational Life, a memoir of sorts, published by Michigan. So John Swartz.
Thank you.
Richard has asked me to go first because I actually only have 9 years' experience working in a British university, and most of my time has been spent elsewhere. And what I decided to do is to briefly report on 10 light bulb going off moments in a 50-year career in ESP and EAP. So my first one is 1966. When, as Richard said, I was taking the advanced diploma in linguistics and ELT at Leeds University, and I was looking for a dissertation topic. So I looked at the previous dissertations, and I found one, unfortunately I cannot remember what his name was, which compared the original science articles and their write-ups in the Science Reports section of the Times. And the journalistic accounts were shown to be lexically, syntactically, metaphorically, and idiomatically more complex than the originals. I have always remembered this. I've always been a bit dubious about using journalistic accounts as any kind of modeling for our students' writing. Number two, 1968, College of Engineering, University of Libya. We taught Engineering and Scientific English for 5 hours in year one, 3 hours in year two, and nothing in years three, four, and five before they got their degrees. What to teach? Needs analysis would suggest teach them to read the textbooks and to follow lectures. But wait, I said, what if we asked another question? Where is teacher intervention and classroom interaction most necessary and essential for their students? We could conclude that they must struggle with the reading and the listening on their own, and what we should do with help, because that's where the teacher intervention was needed, with scientific writing and semi-technical speaking in a language lab, and so on. 1976, number three, University of Khartoum in the Sudan. First year classes in English for academic legal purposes. Helping the students reading criminal case reports. And I was doing it all wrong. This is not narrative reading. These are not stories. It is reading to find the legal point that really counts, the so-called stare decisis. So another light bulb going off moment. 1980. University of Aston, in the library, reading a review of a book by the cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz about Indonesia. The review talks about the ritualized genres of courtly life. Genre. This is the term that I've been looking for the last year or two. 1981, opening my copy of the journal, New Journal, English for Specific Purposes. and reading an article by Elaine Tarone and some of her colleagues at the University of Washington. In methods, she said, the passive is used for standard procedures. The active, with sentences beginning I or we, is used for innovations. Not a prior choice of using either one or the other, which up to that time I had been teaching. For a lab report, either choose the passive or choose I or we or whatever. So there we have an early, strong form-function correlation. But I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, my later attempts to validate that hypothesis have not been successful. Number six, the University of Michigan, 1985. I go to a talk in the English department by composition expert Lillian Bridwell Bowles. She talks of discourse communities and how different they are from the speech communities beloved by sociolinguists. Number seven, 1992, University of Birmingham. Tim Johns shows me his kibitzer on whether data is singular or plural, whether in science people write data is or data are. I suddenly see the merit of specialized corpora. 1996, University of Michigan, on the College Promotion Committee. I am reading a philosopher's work who is up for promotion, who at one point writes, and do not even attempt to argue that. Hey, I say, you can't do that. Let's look at imperatives in academic writing across various disciplines. 2001, reading Paul Charney and Kendall's piece in Written Communication, in which they argue that we've paid too much attention to the processes of getting academic stuff published, not enough to the reception of that stuff afterwards. Only by paying attention to the latter can we ever show that writing is important, that a standard introduction works to the writer's advantage and an oddball one that does not. One reception study showing that the two most successful articles in English for Specific Purposes journal in 1980s were written, A, by women, two, by non-native speakers of English, and three, by people working in out-of-the-way places. Tells you something. The other, showing that Sonny Heon's article, Genre in Three Traditions, has been primarily successful because later writers have used it as a framing device. Number 10, and last, 2012, conference in Zaragoza, paper by Juan Carlos Palma and Miguel Garrido. They argue, intensifiers like very and superlatives like most are rare in academic writing and relatively uncommon in academic speaking. When they do occur in academic speaking, they are associated with more dramatic gestures and postures. Up until then, I never thought that multimodal analysis was cost-effective, was worth the time and effort that people were putting into it. But I can now see that if you start with a distinctive verbal feature, like superlatives, you can probably hang quite quickly some useful non-verbal features onto it. So, 10 moments in 45 years, which in each case has led me to somewhere different. I could have chosen more, but 10 is a round number, and my time is short.
We'd be delighted if you talk for more, I'm sure, but would anybody like to come back or to ask anything or comment on anything that we've been talking about so far? Any questions or comments? Because as I said, yes, we'll bring the microphone to you.
Thank you. What were the two most important articles written by women in the 80s?
One was the article by Anna Maurerden.
Oh, yes.
Finland, comparing economics articles written by Anglo-American economists and Finnish economists writing in English. And the other was an article by François Sala-Germer from Venezuela, which looked at hedges, the variation in the occurrence and distribution of hedges in the various parts of journal articles.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to say anything? Andrew? Pass the microphone forward to the front row, please.
You certainly have been able to verify the claim about the I and the we.
Yeah.
I just wondered whether you've been able to empirically verify the claim that superlatives were not common in academic writing.
That's very interesting, because until I heard that paper, it was last December that I heard that paper. I had never thought of that. Mm. And when I heard it, I thought, that makes sense. How often do I use very important? And I guess...
It's just I've been looking at explanations in law corpus, and they very frequently begin with some kind of claim using a superlative. This is the most important area. But it's the type of writing, it's not a journal article.
And in lectures, we say.
Now,
this is the really important thing we need to remember that.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. But...
But in research articles, not. John, in the introduction to episodes in ESP, you write that, because it does take a historical approach, although as you say, it's not a history of ESP. that's my job, or others. But one aim was to, let me just see, you say that practitioners, the term you prefer, ESP practitioners, tend not to look across to other ESP situations and to other ESP endeavours, whether similar or dissimilar to their own, to see what lessons might be learned, what insights might be gained, or what useful shortcuts can be made. Nor do they often look back to previous work in their own departments or in others. My feeling is that such isolationist attitudes can lead to reduplication of effort and inefficient use of time. My hope is that this volume will do something to persuade the profession that contributions from other places and other times are at least potentially relevant to the here and now. Do you still believe that?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it will work, yes.
One of the first things I remember about John Swales was he said, we must beware of reinventing the wheel. And it is certainly still going on, isn't it, reinventing the wheel?
I have a question. John, interesting 10 moments. I'm thinking, if you were specifically asked to make those 10 light bulb moments for EAP, how many of them would be discounted? Because many of them were, in fact, ESP moments. Which, of course, invites you to the greater question of, do you actually believe, and we've talked about this in the past, that there is a real distinction between ESP and EAP?
Well, I would think most of those moments were actually EAP in the sense that I define it. If you are thinking that EAP has to be disciplinary specific, but I don't think. But some people tend to say that it should be disciplined. But if it's not disciplinary specific, I think that rather few of those moments are ESP in the sense that none of them are concerned with business. And the law students are in a university studying an academic subject. So
there's no professional English, there's no English in the workplace.
Right.
In any of that, he makes it EAP.
I can't remember what Tyrone's context was.
It was articles in astrophysics.
Astrophysics.
because they had an astrophysicist as a specialist informant.
In the university?
At the University of Washington.
You mentioned that you've discovered that non-native speakers write and publish as well in English. I wonder what that discovery was like for you, and what were the particular non-native articles that you discovered?
This was the reception study, since I know both of the people who came top, I was very pleased, and so were they.
Okay.
But of course, they are the kind of non-native speaker who are professors of English and who are very expert users of the language, much more expert than the great majority of native speakers. So it's a slight, I'm pushing the boat a little bit when I say they were both non-native speakers. They were multilingual.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we'll move on and we'll come back for more discussion later. I'd like to introduce Andy Gillette. More briefly than I introduced John. But for the last 25 years, most of Andy's work has been in EAP, in British Higher Education. Until 2009, he was at the University of Hertfordshire. Now he has his own English language and educational consultancy. For many years involved with BALEEP, was the chair and is now the treasurer of BALEEP. And I believe you're going to be talking about the history of BALEEP. Great.
I'm sorry, I've got a few PowerPoint slides. I just thought this is me, just to put me in a bit of EAP context. I was chair from 2003 to 2005. Some of you might not know, but we've got a lot of chairs and previous chairs at this conference. I can see in front of me Michael Hughes, who was chair, Maggie Ward, Goodbody, who was chair, John Turner, you've already met, who was chair. There's also Jean Godfrey, who was chair, and, as I'll mention again, Merrill, who has been chair of this organisation. I also noticed that I've been involved in BALEEP since 94. I wasn't allowed to be involved in BALEEP before 94 because I worked for a college of FE. And a question for Merrill later on, I wasn't allowed to be involved in BALEEP because FE, even though I was teaching a University of Warwick programme in the College of FE, I wasn't allowed to be a member. That has now changed. So basically, I've got a timeline of BALEEP. A bit like John, I've got 10 examples on this timeline that I think are relevant to the development of BALEEP. So on top of John's discussion of EAP, I'll try and tell you something about how I think BALEEP has developed, and then Merrill will give some good examples, I hope. BALEEP started, as you've heard, in 1972 as an organisation called CELMUS. John writes in his memoirs, is it CELMUS or CELMOUS? We don't know. Special English language materials for overseas, word we don't use anymore, university students. Particularly interested with a group of four universities in the early days, Birmingham, Newcastle, Manchester and Leeds, interested in sharing research. Research in those days was primarily on student needs, I think, and producing materials. It developed, other institutions joined, and after a while there were 10 or 11 or 12 institutions, and Aston was one of them. When did Aston join? 75 or 76 or something, I think. Again, you might remember.
77, I think. Probably before that.
Yeah.
I talked to her the other day and she said 75.
Okay, so 1972, CELMUS, so that makes us, 41? Is that older than some people in the room? I hope there are some people in the room younger than 41. A lot of people older than 41, I know. first conference in 75 at University of Birmingham, and Richard's already shown you the front page of that, the green document, this one, sorry. Should be there, it's not. Anyway. With Baal, interesting, if you look at some of the titles of some of the presentations, again, there's an MA dissertation here in, I don't know if you've seen Richard's recent article in ELT Journal, where with a colleague he looks at CLT, communicative language teaching, through searches in ELT Journal, he's looked at the development of that. And I think there are MA dissertations, etc., around in looking at how titles of conference presentations have changed. Interestingly, out of the presentations here, the word problem occurs 6 times. We don't consider our students to have problems these days, do we? The word overseas, is there a lot? Again, in this country, we have problems with the word overseas. Overseas sometimes contrasts with European, and everybody's international. It used to be to do with funding. Overseas students paid more, but now everybody pays the same, so things don't matter. But interestingly, Bob Jordan's first presentation here, identification of problems and needs. So in the early days, it seems that's what we were interested in, needs, problems, and trying to find solutions in materials. And again, on the last page, problems and strategies, problem of grammar, quite a few of the word problems. We wouldn't use that anymore, would we? Interestingly now, we're coming to 89, and this was when Muriel was chair. And I think it's very important that in the next few years, three, I think, very important changes in Baal happened under Muriel's chairship, which is why it's fantastic that she's actually here. So let me tell you what I think these are. SELMAS became the British Association of Lecturers in English for Academic Purposes in 89. A lot of discussion, John mentions it in his memoirs, and in the minutes, which is what I'm going on, there are lots of discussions about. Is it John who talks about at a loss? Mm. I think, was it Greg James from Exeter? They had the Association of Teachers or something or other, a nice acronym, until they realised that when they read the acronym, it read at a loss. So they decided they couldn't have at a loss. Baal-eep, again, I've talked to Meryl about this. The use of the word British was still considered important. In fact, it was considered important until 2007. What do you think? Again, I was at Gosh's talk the other day, and we're looking at the whole idea of identity and EAP and to what extent it is British or American. So that was the first, was one thing Meryl did. Changed to Baal-eep because, again, according to Bob Jordan's account, Baal-eep was becoming more interested in just materials. Professional development, research, a lot of things like this. Another thing that happened in Muriel's time was the professional issues meetings, which have been going now since 89. First run by Mike Beacon in Sheffield. The last 10 years have been run by Andy Seymour. Those of you in this country will know. Those of you not in this country might not know. This fantastic series of day meetings that Andy's run over the last 10 years. Fantastic. 54 people at the first one. The first 10, which I've tried to get information on and can't, was English for Law at University of Leicester. And 53 people attended. And we've had 44 PIMS since then, with a total of 548 presentations. All available for research if anybody would like to look at any trends. And the accreditation scheme. Again, those of you based in this country will know about the accreditation scheme. It was thought about that time, Muriel might have more to say about this, that Baal-eep should be doing something about the external accreditation of our courses. And there are various, should we get the British Council to do it? Should we have an external examining type system, or should we have our own accreditation scheme? We set up our own accreditation scheme, which, I don't know, I'm looking at Maggie, who was involved with it for a long time, has always had a strong supporting smallish group.
something we've often thought about. How does it develop? But out of this, out of accreditation, because one of the aspects of accreditation is teacher qualifications, teacher experience, it became clear that Bali probably needed to do something about training of EAP teachers. On the first day in the introductory talk, we were told that Nottingham, under Alex Ding, has started an MA in EAP. They say it's the only one in the country. It's certainly not the first one that's existed. Others have come and gone through lack of student numbers. So let's hope they do better in Nottingham. TEEP, as we called it, Teaching English for Academic Purposes. Again, it took 10 years to develop. A PIM, a Professional Issues Meeting in 97 at Sussex, Bath, run by Maggie in 2001, Exeter in 2004. Gradually, over 10 years, we came up with a system, starting with a definition of EAP teachers' competences, and now working on some sort of accreditation for EAP teachers, which we will go further. So that's TEEP in 97. First website, important, in 1999. We had the first website, run by Corrie Hilary-Nesse, Hilary's student, Benita, in those days. It's developed a bit over the years, again, but always we've tried to keep up to date with modern technology. You will see how it's changed, and this is the present one, which I hope some of you are familiar with. Restes. Going back 10 years, Bali members have always done some sort of research. But again, a long time ago, we agreed that, and again, at the Southampton Conference in 2003, again, Maggie Ward, good buddy, together with George Blue and Joe McDonough, had a meeting where they decided that Bali really needed to do something serious to get members doing research. It took a long time, but finally, that's Leah there, isn't it? And under Leah Blage Ward and colleagues before her, she set up this RESTES research training event series, which has run over the last couple of years. Very successful, I think. So I think finally, Bali has got where it should be with regard to research training. We just have to see how that develops into publications. Because we don't get a lot of submissions to JEEP from Bali practitioners. Again, that's something that we need to work on, I think. For many years, Bali was an association. And Andy Seymour, particularly, when the universities changed from writing checks to more electronic-based accounts, people kept asking Andy, what is Bali? And we didn't have an answer. We're an association. And the electronic forms they were filling in, they couldn't fill them in. So we decided, for many reasons as well, that we needed to become a charity. In 1994, the solicitors advised us that there was no advantage whatsoever in Bali becoming a charity. But in the last few years, Bali has become a registered company and a charity, which makes it much easier. Other reasons for universities to pay us. And the last thing connected with all that, lots of things happened around that time. Changes into membership, connected to outsourcing and privatisation of some of the EAP in British universities. Up to that time, you basically had to be a British university to join. Whether or not we wanted overseas members, of course we did. Whether or not we allowed FE colleges and private providers, all that changed. So now we have a much broader membership. And at that time, we decided we'd change the name. So we changed the name from the British Association of Lecturers in English for Academic Purposes to BALEEP. The name of the organisation is BALEEP. That does not stand for anything at all, it's a word. If you want, like somebody told me last night, to keep using the words British Association, that's fine. But the legal name for the association is now BALEEP. With the strapline, the Global Forum for EAP, which is what we think it should be. A lot of people say, look, BALEEP is British, isn't it? Why should other organisations join? We've got members in China, Switzerland, Egypt. We hope we're developing. Okay, so that's, I hope, a quick view, for those of you who don't know, of how EAP, how Bali has developed within the context of EAP. And I hope Richard's now going to introduce Meryl, who is going to fill in, I hope, some of the gaps. Do you want to leave a picture on?
No, I Unless you want it.
Well, thank you, Andy. Very good overview of timeline of development of Salmas and Bali. Now, let me introduce Meryl. Yes, you can stand at the lectern. Yeah, okay. I hope this is on. Meryl is associate, again, needs no introduction, but I think it's respectful and worthwhile to introduce her to those of you under 41. Meryl is an associate fellow of the University of Warwick. I'm happy to stay still. And because that's where I am, and she has been an associate fellow of the University of Warwick since her retirement from Warwick in 2000, which is just when I arrived at Warwick University. And I was very happy to get to know Meryl a little bit then. And I'm very happy that she could join us today. Meryl taught English in the UK and then for 12 years in Ethiopia and Botswana. Please correct me if I'm wrong again. And largely in ESP in those two countries. From 1977 to 1984, Meryl lectured on the MSc in ESP program at Aston in Birmingham, before joining Warwick, in, I suppose, 1984. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is actually when Kelty, as it was, began. So you were a founder.
Actually, I went part-time for the first year, and then full-time in 1985.
Yeah. So the much regretted and beloved Kelty Centre for English Language Teacher Education, which I joined in 2000. Meryl was there, now the Centre for Applied Linguistics. Meryl was there until 2000. She's published widely in journals and published chapters in books, written textbooks, and developed tests. And she, of course, was active in Salmas. In the programme it says she was one of the first chairs of Salmas. Of course, that's wrong. I wrote that, it was wrong. She was the last chair of Salmas, which then became Ballyip under in your time. She has interest particularly in applications of systemic functional grammar, and recent books include The Functional Analysis of English with Tom Bloor and The Practice of Critical Discourse Analysis. So thank you, Meryl.
Thank you. Well, I'll start with a little story. I was with a group of young people, my grandchildren, a few weeks ago, and they started talking about the rise of feminism, and one of them said, well, I understand that there was a demonstration from feminists in London in 1963, and my 20-year-old granddaughter turned to me and she said, Gran, where were you in 1963? And I said, in Ethiopia teaching EAP. Which is true. I was not in London demonstrating for pessimism or for feminism. I've actually been involved in teaching AP for about 60 years, so I beat you, John. But to go back to Salmas, I came back to England in 1975. To do a master's degree at Essex University, where I met Steve and Joe McDonough, who were working in providing English language service English for overseas students in the university. It's interesting that on that MA course that I was on, at least five people are now still involved in EAP around the world, so it was quite a significant time. When I had finished at Essex, I moved to Aston University in 77. There I was appointed just to teach EAP. It was 3 years before we got the MSc going. Now, I was working with someone called Kath Johns, now Kath Johns-Lewis, who was married to Tim Johns at Birmingham, that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, who was started one of the biggest programs in
EAP in Britain at Birmingham University, and he was one of the founder members of Thelma's in 1972. I went to my first Thelma's meeting in 1975 when I was taken by Jo McDonough, because she knew I was working on a book for Africa, which was called Reading for a Purpose. That book was for upper secondary schools originally in Nigeria and was then used all over southern Africa. It was published by Macmillan but was never available in Britain, although it was essentially early EAP. It was designed to encourage secondary school students to read in the fields of study that they were working in and to approach reading from a point of view of trying to find out things and reading for specific reasons. And that was a series of books. I did book three. Neville Grant worked on book one and book two. And we had African colleagues that were helping us with those books. I don't know whether they're still used in Africa. I haven't seen a copy for donkey's years, but it was essentially early EAP, which Jo saw, and she invited me to come along to Thelma's. At that first meeting of Thelma's I went to, there were fewer than 10 people. I've tried to list the people that were there, and I think I remember correctly that there was Keith Johnson, Bob Jordan, Brian Heaton, Tim Johns, Catherine Johns, Jo McDonough and Steve McDonough. Maybe John Holmes was there because he was also at Essex at the same time. And David Hall, who is now at Macquarie University. Coming to England in the 1970s was quite interesting, because if you're looking at the development of EAP, you have to think of the whole educational scene. For one thing, England was a technological desert in 1975. It's very difficult for people nowadays to imagine just what it was like. For example, well, you know, there were no mobile phones, there were no computers, there were no videos, there were no none of the things that we just take for granted nowadays. In Botswana, I had worked in a training college for government officials and people employed by the government in Botswana. And there we had a film studio with a 16mm film projector and films provided by the British Council. We also had a dedicated English language classroom with an overhead projector in it. When I went to Aston in 77, you could get an overhead projector, but only if you ordered it at least a week in advance, and it wasn't needed by somebody else in the university. It was delivered to your room for a particular lecture. We didn't have any photocopying facilities, except for the cyclostyling machine. That's right, I see somebody turning his hand, so you may remember that. So it was a very, very different world. But although when I went to a Thelma's meeting, what happened was that the 10 people who were usually there came along with samples of materials that they'd written themselves and typed out, and maybe cyclostyled copies, and we passed them around and we discussed them, and we compared them with what we'd been doing in class, and we chatted about how you might use them, and it was a very, very different world, I can tell you, a very different world. But although it was a technological desert, the 1970s in England was a sort of hotbed of linguistic fever. Because what had happened was that in the 50s, I think think probably John would correct me about when the first diploma in applied linguistics had started at Edinburgh University and then at Leeds University. There were people talking about the importance of language training, of text analysis, of linguistics in general, and how it could be used in education. And the master's courses were starting in the 1970s. I selected Essex as a place to go because Essex had already reached some fame because Peter Strevens was professor there. Actually, he left by the time I got there, but he was a professor when I applied, and he had written, well, he was writing, it was actually, I'd seen a distributed copy of the article, but it was not actually published until 1971, a very important paper called Daffodils, Alternatives to Daffodils, which he based on his experiences in Africa, where he found that in the secondary schools where students really needed language for their academic purposes, they were learning I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud and all sorts of other, doing all sorts of very culturally specific English literature courses. There was a big report that came out of West Africa called the Grieve Report, which I've tried to trace recently, but I can't get hold of a copy of it, which was a report on the West African results in the English school certificate examinations. And it was a challenge to say that really English school certificate was inappropriate for the kind of English courses that were needed in Africa at that time, and that was also very important. Over in Chile, Ewer and Latour were working on teaching scientific English. All around the world, in Washington, as John's already mentioned, there were, and Michigan, I believe, there were Americans who were working on academic English and beginning to publish. Although Chomsky had already sort of come like a big flash in the pan into American linguistics, in Britain there was still masses of descriptive and functional linguistics going on. Palladian linguistics, systemic functional linguistics, as we now call it, was being taught, and there were conferences on SFL in the 1970s, which were very, very influential. And that was also very exciting because it seemed as though it was something that would be very applicable to education. And I think what happened was that to some extent the linguistic fervor died out, partly because Chomsky and linguistics, transformational grammar, very narrow diachronic syntax, non-functional linguistics became taught in the universities. But functional linguistics did survive. It kept on going, particularly descriptive linguistics. And I think that was very valuable, and it led into a lot of the publications. There was this very amazing publication in wasn't actually published until 1981, but pretty well everything in it was written in the 1970s, which was Salinger, Tarone and Tanzelli, English for Academic and Technical Purposes from the University of Washington, in which John had a paper, and many of the people who have known in EAP had articles. And that a lot of that work was concerned with what we called sort of grammatical rhetorical dependencies, the relationship between the grammar, the lexis, and the use to which those forms were put in language, the sort of thing that we heard in the plenary this morning from Caroline Coffin. I also remember very strongly that at that time systemic functional linguistics was very much more ethnographic, which Caroline Coffin was talking about today, because of course one of the major influences on Holliday was Malinowski, who was an ethnographer, and who first, I think, was the first person, in modern times anyway, to really look at the way the meaning of utterances was completely governed by the context in which it was used. Looking at things like fati communi and language in particular, workplaces and so on. I'm going on, I'm talking too much. So this is all before Bali started, really. I'm just trying to give you a picture of what it was like in the 1970s. There were very few people working. Salmas was set up, and as Andy has already mentioned, Salmas was a closed shop. Now, I had completely forgotten this. But 2 weeks ago, I was at Tony Dudley Evans' 70th birthday party. And Tony Dudley Evans was a big EAP, ESP person at Birmingham University, who wrote a book on ESP, which some of you may have read. And he now works almost entirely with jazz. But at his birthday party, I met Maggie Jo St. John, who was also at Aston in the 1970s. Well, in fact, we taught her, didn't we? She was a student first, and then she taught one of our best students. And a woman named Joanna Channel, who worked at Nottingham at one time. Some of you may know her. Anybody know Joanna Channel? Yeah. And I was talking, and they said, I hear you're going to be at Bali next week. And I said, yes. And Joanna Channel and Maggie Jo then told me about what happened when they tried to go to a Selmas meeting, when they tried to join Selmas. And I'd completely forgotten all about this. And she said, we went along to the meeting and they said, you'll have to wait outside while we discuss whether you are suitable to be admitted as a member of Selmas. And they had to go wait in another room, and we had a meeting, and I can't remember this meeting. And she said after about half an hour, someone came out and said, and they thought it was Tim Johns, but they weren't absolutely sure, and said, yes, we are pleased to welcome you as members of Selmas. And the this seems so strange now that it could ever happen, really, but apparently it did happen. And so I looked back in some of the documents to see what kind of criteria we had for admitting people, if this had been discussed or written down anywhere. And I did find some notes, which, as Andy said, they must be teaching overseas students in a British university. They had to be. Now, in fact, we waived that. In the case of, I can't remember if it was Joanna, one of those two people said they weren't actually teaching at that time, but they were applying for jobs. They had to be appropriately qualified. That is, they had to know something about linguistics and education. And they had to be really keen. I noticed that really keen was sort of underlined, and interested in students, and preferably had overseas experience. And I would like to make the point that very much all the way through, from Selmas to Bali to now, I think, EAP was an international project. Most of the people who started EAP in Britain got involved because there were increasing numbers of overseas students coming into the country and because they did need support. And most of those people had been involved in EAP somewhere else around the world. And these were the people that were here, and probably lots of you here today have overseas experience as well. And a lot of the countries around the world, I mean, we've already mentioned Finland, Indonesia, Malaysia, have been mentioned at this conference, most of China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Latin America, all these places, EAP is going on and is still going on, and a lot of the major work in EAP is going on there. And so it must remain an international project. I think EAP has to be an international project, a linguistic project, and an educational project. I think I'm probably running out of time. Have I got time to say something about the Bali accreditation scheme? Okay, since Andy mentioned it, I do actually have here a copy, which actually came across my phone, of an article that I wrote in 1994. I was asked to write an article for the Journal of International Education in 1993. It was published in 1994. And it was supposed to be talking about English language proficiency in British education, measuring quality and raising standards. That was what it was called. But I was given the title. And in it, I wrote quite a lot about MALEEP and as it was by that time. And about the accreditation scheme. The accreditation scheme, I think Andy's representation wasn't actually quite right. I was at the time a British Council inspector. They set up a scheme for inspecting private language schools, and I was one of their inspectors. And they decided, the British Council decided, that there were some awful things going on in British universities, and that they should inspect British universities. And when I passed on this message to other people in Bali, we all agreed that the British Council were not the best people to do it. And so we got together and discussed the possibility of Bali setting up an accreditation scheme and asking the British Council to approve it and to discuss it. And I think I wrote quite a lot of the papers for that proposal, but I don't think I have them anymore. I don't know whether they survived at all. But in this article in 1994, I said, so far, 30 universities have been inspected. Of these, 25 have received accreditation. Two have failed to receive accreditation, and three have been referred for improvements in the course. Of the two failed courses, one has already applied for re-inspection after making improvements in the light of the report. In addition, six universities were inspected this summer for the first time, and the inspectors' reports are currently being considered. And I go on to say what makes a good course and what were the problems with the courses that failed or were referred, which is quite interesting. Someone put in their report that since most students were highly intelligent and well motivated to learn the language which would help them towards academic success, they were therefore unwilling to waste time and money chatting in class, that this was called practicing conversation by the course organisers, that the students were very unhappy at attending a course which seemed to them to be nearly a rehash of the type of secondary school language instruction that they had had before, under which they had failed to acquire English. Another problem that was mentioned was that many courses were not resourced properly. there weren't proper books or learning materials, and that students didn't use the university library because the people on the course had not introduced them to using British libraries. And finally, that many staff on this failed course were people who had simply been transferred from a closed classics department to look after the overseas students' language problems. Okay, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, very interesting. Well, we've got about 5 minutes, unfortunately, for general discussion again. Would anybody like to comment or have questions? Yes.
One thing I know of only by picking it up, because I'm not a native of this country, but it seems to me, and I haven't heard it discussed, but it seems to me important for our field, is a shift from overseas students being paid for by the UK government, as I understand, to a situation in which students are a source of income for universities. And I don't know whether this happened in a flash, the same way tuition fees have gone up, or whether it was a gradual process of some students being on scholarship as part of the Imperial Project, and then students started saying, well, can I pay to come?
Michael, Maggie, anything? Any comment on that?
Wasn't it Margaret Thatcher's problem?
Right? Wrong person.
My recollection, as far as I don't know exactly when it happened, but there was an introduction of fees in the early 90s. Introduction of fees in the 80s. For overseas students, but there was still quite a lot of overseas students who were coming on British Council scholarships or who were paid for by their own governments to come. I suppose that still happens. But it wasn't difficult for the overseas students to enter the country. They didn't have all this immigration nonsense that they've introduced nowadays. But I think the fees were much more reasonable, of course, originally, and they did increase rapidly as the economy, and Andy had quite a lot to say about money, because when Salmas was there, and in the early days, of course, nobody got funding for anything, but everything was cheap. Universities didn't charge for the use of rooms, so if we wanted a meeting, and this was during the 80s as well, the early 80s, if you wanted a room, the university would provide it, if it was on a Saturday or if it wasn't being used by students. And we paid our own fares, but rail fares were cheap.
Can I just add a sentence? I mean, this conference is costing £75,000-£80,000. The first conference was free.
Yes, free.
I think that this is the economics. It seems to me hard to do a history of Bali and EAP without talking about money.
Right, yes, absolutely.
Yes, and it's of interest why Bali started at that time. I mean, this is quite interesting, this Perrin report, because of the 50,000 overseas students at that time, 30,000 were Commonwealth students. This is 1963, and perhaps that situation had changed by 1972. And it'd be of great interest to know why Bali at that time began. In fact, I just wanted to add something, because in this folder from Jane Jordan, from Bob Jordan. It is quite interesting on the origins, right at the very first meetings, and I'm going to pass this to you, Andy, because it did seems to me, and this is just a theory at this time, based on this, that there was almost a kind of rush to found Bali, and it was only about 8 people in different institutions, partly because, it seems to me, from this correspondence, Henry Widdowson and the British Council were planning a meeting later in the same year. And this is a theory, okay, this is not completely, you know, evidence-based, but that there was a desire from the frontline practitioners, as they called themselves, to get together, to not to have a voice, as it were, in these developments which were happening at the British Council level. And that's why I showed you these two documents sort of almost in parallel, the British Council ETIC document, English for Academic Study, with special reference to science and technology, very heavily applied linguistic, and the more, more practically oriented one of the first Bali Pambal proceedings. So I just wondered if that is a tension or a sort of something that has run through Bali or not. I mean, that seems to be a reason for founding Bali at that time.
Yeah. I'd like to just make a very short comment and then a little anecdote relating to Bob Jordan. Andy, I was quite disappointed that on your timeline you didn't have 2002 as the emergence of Jeep, because Bali had a tremendous role in convincing the publishers that there was such a thing as EAP and there were people who would read about it. And Joe McDonough and others who were on the committee at that time played an important part, and I like to think that we're being useful to members of Bali. But in relation to Bob Jordan, I asked Bob to be one of the authors in Volume 1, Issue 1, which he did, and he sent me his paper, and it was typed on a typewriter, and it came through what we now call snail mail. This is in 2001. And it was about 12,000 or 14,000 words long. And so I had to write back to him and say, well, could you revise and do this and that and make it about 7,500 words long? And he wrote back to say, there's no way I can type all this again, even if I could think of how to shorten it. And so, in fact, I had to reduce it, and he's probably told lots of you the story of that, because he's never, ever forgiven me for what I've done to his article. But I am glad that there is still enough left that you can get a bit of feeling of the history from it.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid we're going to have to end on that note. I just wanted to mention one more name, which comes from the Vera Adamson. Was one of the organisers of this first Salmas meeting, and Ron Mackay comes across as somebody very important in the first, founding time. I just wanted to throw those names in, because I think we've mentioned all the major figures at the beginning. I'm afraid we've got to end, really. Sorry, Mary. Something very, very beautiful.
Okay, just one sentence. One thing I meant to mention, but I've forgotten, I didn't have time, was that education or methods change, technology changes, teaching and knowledge change, but we often forget that the language changes as well. So I've heard a few things said at this conference about the English language, and I would invite you all to say, you know, keep looking at the language, because it's changing all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been sort of talking under the eyes or the watchful eyes of the god Janus, Janus, all four of them, his eyes, I mean, and looking back to look ahead. Well, we've been mainly looking back, haven't we? But I invite you to look forward based on what you've been hearing today, and I hope it has been of interest and relevance to the future. We've been addressing the theme of the conference. Janus is the god of transitions. If you feel that EAP needs a god, then he's your man, I think, because transitions is what EAP is all about, isn't it? And so very appropriate as a guardian deity of EAP, but he's also the god of beginnings. So that's what we really would like you to think about. Is history of relevance to the profession? If so, how can it be promoted? And January, of course, is the name January comes from Janus, but it happens every year. So this is not this was not the Janus moment. It's something that I feel, anyway, we should have more of, and have Janus moments throughout your
professional lives. And I would like to thank very much indeed John Swales, Mary Oldenburg, Angie Gillette for such fascinating insights. Thank you. Program for the 21st anniversary conference in Birmingham, and one thing that's very notable is they had a panel discussion because we had to